From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, songwriters may soon get paid more for streaming, thanks in part to Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator and songwriter Orrin Hatch. Then Taiwan-based playwright Stan Lai has a new work based on an ancient Chinese text, why his first English play may not be his last.
Me being in Los Angeles and working with actors from America, I think that had a big influence on the way I'm writing this. And at this point in my career, it's time to be a bridge between East and West.
And we'll hear about the LA legacy of musician Alice Coltrane, all that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair. Called inspirational and invigorating by the LA Times, the documentary follows 9 high school students on their journey to change the world through science. ScienceFairFilm.com. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Streaming services may have made discovering music convenient for consumers, but it hasn't been as beneficial for the people who actually write those songs. Thanks to some archaic laws, songwriters were getting a tiny percentage of a penny per stream. So in 2016, Kay Hanley and Michelle Lewis, two songwriters based in LA, decided to get active. Yesterday, they got a huge win when their Music Modernization Act passed the U.S. Senate, thanks to bipartisan backing from lawmakers, including Orrin Hatch and Elizabeth Warren, who don't often agree on very much. They also got some last-minute support this week from Paul McCartney, Carole King, and other prominent artists who threatened to boycott Sirius XM when the satellite radio company stood in the way. When Michelle Lewis and Kay Hanley came by today, I asked them how they learned the news that their bill had passed the Senate.
We watched it live on C-SPAN, just like everyone.
So you're the
does.
Two people watching C-SPAN.
The live text threads I had going with the biggest rock stars and songwriter names. I mean, I'm literally
and my
you can't
mom.
Just say and, that. Who are you texting with?
Desmond Child, Ryan Tedder, Irving Azoff.
Yeah.
We're just literally watching C-SPAN. No, not even just C-SPAN.
C-SPAN 2.
Wasn't even good enough to get on C-SPAN.
But to back up just a little bit, we had heard this week that our bill was undergoing a process called it was being hotlined.
Yes.
And
they don't cover hotlining in the I'm Just a Bill song on Schoolhouse Rock.
No, they do not. Well, we didn't really get it until it was actually happening on the floor. But ultimately, what hotlining means is that behind closed doors, there are certain uncontroversial bills that are kind of just like agreed to in literally what's called the cloakroom.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And if pretty much everyone agrees on it, so they're not going to waste time on the floor, debating it.
So Mitch McConnell, who decides these things, had said to us, he'd sort of given us a checklist of things like, here's how you can get, I will allow your bill to go for a vote. And it was, literally a checklist, like get this many co-sponsors, which was 51. We ended up getting 82. And then resolve these issues, which were, it was like a video game of, throwing a block and throwing another block, of getting over these hurdles of very sort of inside baseball issues that needed to be sort of worked out in the language. And then
make sure everyone agrees. And then, of course, we had to slay many enemies along the way to getting there, which we'll name names if you want.
Well,
later.
We'll get to the slaying. But what I want to do first is step back so people understand how rights are tied to songs, because I think that's one of the critical issues. So I have an example. In 1982, the band Toto writes a song called Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It's written by David Paich and Jeff Porcaro. So they have the composition of the song. They've written the music and the lyrics for this song. Toto then performs the song. So then there is a performance that they have of this song. And then years later, inexplicably, Weezer decides to cover Africa. So how does the Music Modernization Act affect something like that? Will it benefit songwriters going forward who might not have enjoyed as much upside?
This will help the songwriter piece of the equation, because before, songwriters used to make a living from what was called the mechanical right, and that was from the sale of an album. In streaming, there was no mechanical right assigned to a stream. Now, because of the Orrin G. Hatch Music Modernization Act, there is a mechanical that is migrated from the sale of an album. Now there is one in, there is a tiny mechanical right in a stream. And that is how songwriters will now get paid for their work.
Let's talk a little bit more about Orrin Hatch. Words you'll not hear me say very often. He actually wrote some music. He wrote some songs with Janis Kat Perry. Let's listen to one of their compositions. It's called My God Is Love.
Wow.
My God is love, and in this world of sin, He helps me see that I am safe with Him.
So how did this act get renamed for Orrin Hatch, and what did his leadership on this bill mean for its passage?
That was amazing. And so Orrin Hatch is friends with Paul Williams, the Paul Williams who wrote Evergreen and is the chairman of the board of ASCAP, and had written songs with Paul. And I think Paul was the sort of advocate for the songwriting community to sort of tell Senator Hatch, look, this has been going on for us. Can you pay attention to this? Can you take a look at this? And that did get the issues that we were dealing with on Senator Hatch's radar. And because he is a member of ASCAP, he gets statements, and he was actually able to see personally and in real time what was happening to royalties in the digital space.
You have talked before about the peril that songwriters faced going forward and even today, about how it was very difficult to make a living as a songwriter. Does this give you some hope that the next generation of songwriters might be able to make more of a living and not have to consider different lines of work?
Yeah, I really believe that enshrining a mechanical within a stream, even if it's tiny, will incentivize all parts of the music business to actually work with the streaming companies to scale the subscription model so that the more people that will pay for music, even if it's just a subscription, and it's, but if it's en masse and that continues to rise, will actually really bring back a creative middle class. And I don't think it's hyperbolic to say it will save the music creator.
Songwriting as a profession.
Yeah.
Michelle and Kay, congratulations. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, you.
Thanks so much, John.
Love, soft as an easy chair.
Coming up, a new theater production turns the lush Huntington Museum Gardens into one big stage.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair, the number one audience award winner at Sundance and South by Southwest. Hailed by critics as inspirational and invigorating and supremely entertaining, the documentary follows nine high school students from around the globe as they navigate rivalries, setbacks, and hormones on their journey to change the world through science. Visit sciencefairfilm.com for more information. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Taiwan-based playwright Stan Lai is virtually synonymous with modern theater there. With more than 30 original plays, Lai's influence on theater in the Chinese-speaking world is well established. Now he has a new play called Night Walk in the Chinese Garden that's a bit different. Although it's inspired by a 16th-century Chinese text, it's his first play written in English. It's a site-specific work that winds along the lakeside path of the Chinese Garden at the Huntington Library, Art Collections, and Botanical Gardens in San Marino. Night Walk is the result of a partnership between CalArts Center for New Performance and the Huntington. The play even features Mr. Huntington himself as a character. We'll get to why that's problematic a little later. I actually met Lai when we were both theater students at UC Berkeley. I was an undergraduate, and he was earning his PhD. He even directed me in a play, and to this day, he doesn't hold my performance against me. When we caught up recently on the grounds of the Huntington, we started with how the location inspired his new work.
The Chinese Garden of the Huntington has itself become a vast theatrical space where I'm spreading out and putting scenes in different pagodas and pavilions for Night Walk. For me as a playwright and storyteller, I think because maybe it's because I started writing plays in Chinese, devising plays in Chinese with actors without a regard to the form, because we were free to do anything we wanted to, and our audience would accept it because we didn't have a tradition of theater.
They didn't know better.
They didn't, in a way, they didn't know better, but in a way, we were also free to experiment with what would work best for our own audience. And so that's why over the years I've done many, many new works, and people say they all look different. And that's why I just love not being limited to any concept of what theater is. To me, and I think I learned this from Shireen Stroker, from my time at Berkeley, from many lessons over the years, is that theater is basically performer and audience, and where you put them, it doesn't matter.
Now, the Chinese gardens at the Huntington are this oasis, but in some ways it's kind of an odd oasis because we're in the middle of San Marino. If you go, you know, a couple miles in any direction, you're going to be among $5 million homes or, you know, at a shopping center. But even as kind of this artificial reproduction of a Chinese garden, as beautiful as it is, how does it transport people, do you think, who are walking in from the city, LA, Pasadena, San Marino, and put them in a different place as an audience and kind of open them up to different kinds of stories?
Well, I think what you say about the garden, the garden itself, I think, is changing. 2 years ago, I was here to do a workshop production of this performance, and I think it's already evolved. You can see the space. It's sort of coming into its own. Though it is a reproduction, I haven't really seen a garden like this in China, and I've been in many of them. And many of the gardens in China, they're more house-oriented. There's lots of buildings. There's lots of architecture. This garden is a big lake, and there's small pavilions around it. It has its own special piece. That's what I want to say. And the thing is, it's never open in the evening. And so our play, Night Walk, goes at night. It's a walk at night in the Chinese garden. And it's really quite magical.
Night Walk is a story that involves different theater traditions. It involves different ways of looking as an audience member at a performance. And I suspect it is a different way that you are working with your cast about creating the story. So how would you say the story itself has developed, and how has the space and your company of actors affected the story that you're trying to tell?
Yeah, well, all my life I've worked in the Chinese language, and this is my first play written in English. So it's, for me, I haven't lived in the United States for a long time, and I come as sort of an observer, but also at the same time, I feel engaged in what's happening. And so I've written a play where the inspiration comes from this ancient Chinese text called the Peony Pavilion, one of the great plays of the Chinese tradition.
15th century, is that right?
16th century, okay. Right. Almost contemporary of Shakespeare. In fact, almost an exact contemporary of Shakespeare. His name was Tang Xianzu. He wrote this incredible play that takes about 10 days to perform, you know. And we've extracted the story itself, which is about, now get this, a maiden falls in love with a man in her dreams. And then after she wakes up, she pines, and then after a few months dies of that love. And I've written for the Chinese garden, one half of the story is based on the Peony Pavilion in China. The other half is rewriting the story for California in the 1920s. And among the cast of those characters is Mr. Huntington. So in the Huntington estate in the 1920s, there is a performance of the Peony Pavilion by Chinese actors from China in the 1920s. And we have gotten some of the foremost actors of the Quinchi style to be performing in the garden.
We're talking with Stan Lai about his new play, Night Walk in the Chinese Garden. We're actually sitting in the Chinese Garden at the Huntington Library Art Collections and Botanical Gardens. When you are wrestling with Huntington's history, it's a dark history in some ways. Mm-hmm. He was part of the robber barons. There were a lot of Chinese laborers who died building the railroads at the time. Mm-hmm. And certainly there was a lot of other people who were working in labor in California at the time who were being exploited. So How much of that laborers and immigrants story is part of the story that you're trying to tell?
In a subtle way, I have one character. Her name is Fragrance, which is the name of a character in the Peony Pavilion. And she is a housemaid in the Huntington estate. And she is called on to clean, amongst other things, the floors, the windows, the dogs, to clean the paintings, because Mr. Huntington really likes the way she cleans paintings. So I'm subtly dealing with these issues in a way that I hope will generate discussion.
How would you describe the writing of this piece? Where did you start? What were the ideas that you wanted to explore? And how did it evolve once you started spending more time in the gardens?
Obviously, what I wanted to explore were East and West, the story retold in California, me being in Los Angeles and working with actors from America. I think that had a big influence on the way I'm writing this. And I really think that at this point in my career, it's time to be a bridge between East and West, since all of my career has been in Taiwan, China, Hong Kong, Singapore, all these places. But very, very seldomly do we perform in America. And now in English here, I think the themes of a very mystical Chinese story being told in two ways. And if you know the garden, you'll know that as an audience, you will be going either clockwise or counterclockwise around the lake. Now, if you go clockwise, you'll see the Chinese scenes first, and then you'll come to the big pavilion at the end where you'll see the Quintry performance, and then you'll see the Western scenes in inverse sequence.
Like reverse chronological order then?
Right. And so if you're going clockwise, it's the same thing. You see the Western scenes in the right order, and then you see them in inverse, the Chinese scenes in inverse order here. So the more I worked, the more I worked into my own interests in what it means to be Eastern and what it means to be Western.
When you were working as a playwright and director in Taiwan, you're kind of creating theater from the ground up because there was no history of modern theater in Taiwan.
That's true.
And here in the States, there are so many conventions that audiences are used to that you're kind of fighting an almost opposite battle. Which one is harder, creating something out of nothing or fighting against perceptions of the way that stories have to be told when there is institutionalized theater knowledge?
That's a great question. I don't think I've ever been asked that question, John. You know, it's hard enough to do something from scratch, to create a theater culture where there was none. When I went back to Taiwan, where we had no tradition of modern theater there, people had never seen a modern Taiwanese play or a modern Chinese play. And so it was up to us to sort of start making them. And that's what I started doing. And you're right. When I come to America, I did one of my most well-known plays called Secret Love in Peach Blossom Land at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival a couple years ago. And I realized, wow, I'm dealing with an audience who I can't expect to know anything about. Where is Taiwan? Where is China? And so I wrote in some jokes into the script. The assistant in one of the plays within the plays says, "Oh, sir, your audience won't know anything about Thailand. I mean, Taiwan, I'm sorry." You know, so the audience got that.
One of the other things I think is worth mentioning is not only are we at the Huntington, but we're in San Marino. And San Marino has a very complicated history about Asian Americans.
I hear.
It was, you know, predominantly a very white Republican town when I was growing up in Pasadena. Now it's much more multicultural, and there are a lot of Asian Americans there. Is that important, too, in terms of the setting of the city where this story is unfolding?
I think so. This production has really amazed me in the fact that it has brought out a lot of support from the Chinese community. And I think people the Chinese community is finally able to say, yeah, let's do something in the arts. Let's do something that makes a difference. And it's cultural, it's artistic. It's something, it's kind of new for the Chinese community, but I think it's going very well.
Stan, it was great to see you.
Hey, John, it's fantastic to see you.
Night Walk is at the Huntington from September 21st through October 26th. Coming up, Alice Coltrane wasn't just the widow of jazz legend John Coltrane. She was a brilliant and influential musician in her own right. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. In the late 1970s, jazz musician Alice Coltrane recorded three albums in Los Angeles for Warner Brothers Records. She had moved here following the death in 1967 of her husband, the saxophone legend John Coltrane. Those LA albums would be her last commercial recordings for more than 25 years, while Coltrane pursued a more spiritual path that would eventually lead to her creation of an ashram near Malibu. This month's reissue of the lost Warner Brothers albums further spotlight Alice Coltrane as her music transitioned from the secular to the sacred. The Frame contributor Stephen Cuevas has our story.
By the time the young Alice McLeod met her future husband, John Coltrane, in 1963, the classically trained musician with a background in gospel had already mastered bebop piano, and like John, she was looking to push jazz further. The couple soon married. They started a family and collaborated musically and spiritually until John's untimely death in 1967 at age 39.
He had that sort of overwhelming presence about him. Mm-hmm. And he never really had to talk or to instruct music. He really didn't have to do that.
Alice Coltrane talked about their brief but profound partnership in a rare 1981 interview on NPR's Piano Jazz.
Just being around him, listening to him express his ideas musically, it really is very inspirational, and it was to many people.
John also encouraged Alice to take up the harp, so he bought her one, and it was delivered to the family's home just weeks after John's death. Coltrane mastered it well enough to play it on her debut 1968 album called A Monastic Trio.
One can only wonder what dedication that takes to get up to the level that she did so fast while she's still in mourning.
Jazz critic Ashley Kahn wrote the liner notes for the new Alice Coltrane reissue.
The only way to explain this is cosmic intervention or really, really deep dedication.
The harp would become a fixture of Alice Coltrane's subsequent albums, including the three reissued this month, recorded for Warner Brothers in Los Angeles between 1975 and 1978. Just a couple years after relocating here from New Jersey, the harp and her piano sit where they have for decades, in the front room of the family home on a spacious semi-rural property in Woodland Hills.
That's the harp.
The harp, and I took the cover off for you. Because it just, we need to see it sometimes.
Daughter Sita Michelle Coltrane, a jazz vocalist, lives there now with her family.
And some mornings she would just play her harp. I've woken up to that harp right behind you.
She'd sometimes join her mom in the Warner Brothers studio too, playing hand percussion and chanting on several songs inspired by traditional Indian devotional songs called bhajans.
Even though it was Sanskrit, we could sing. Jaya Raghupate Raghava Ra Jaram.
It goes all the way back to Africa.
Purusha Hickson also performed on Alice Coltrane's three albums for Warner Brothers.
Coming up into the church and then the association with the great John Coltrane. She brought all of that with her own deep connection with God. Even though she had some questionable musicians, speaking about myself, man.
The family's new life in sunny Southern California and Coltrane's blossoming spirituality is reflected on the song Om Supreme from the album Eternity, her first LA record for Warner. The album is driven by Coltrane's surging Wurlitzer organ that Ashley Kahn says enabled her to bend and stretch the notes.
Which made it sound very Eastern, the way that a sitar player loves to bend the string. She'd hit a certain note and then it would bend a little bit further, and that really becomes part of her sonic vocabulary.
Two more albums for Warner would follow in quick succession. They'd be looser and deeply rooted in gospel and Indian music, awash with exotic percussion and chanting choruses. Purusha Hickson told me the sessions were joyful.
You know, more like a village musician. When there's a celebration, everybody's just picking up a drum or claves or something, you know what I mean? Because you want to participate in the celebration.
By the end of Coltrane's Warner Brothers contract, there were new priorities. The founding of a 50-acre spiritual retreat near Malibu, a focus on devotional music, and the everyday demands of family life. Daughter Sita Michelle says Alice still did the occasional concert, but at select venues only. The jazz club days, they were over.
They were smoking then, the alcohol. This is now a person that's taken spiritual vows, devoting herself to God. It really wasn't a place where you shake your hips. It all fit with the lifestyle that she had chosen.
As Coltrane suggested to Marianne McPartland on NPR's Piano Jazz back in 1981, a new musical phase was taking shape.
What's the label now that you were
All right, I am not contracted. And since the Warner Brothers contract finalized, that was in 1978, and I made the last double record album.
You're still writing and you're still composing.
Yes, definitely.
The music Alice Coltrane would create over the next 25 years was devoted almost entirely to her religious life. She'd released just one more commercial jazz album in her lifetime to wide acclaim in 2004. She died 3 years later at the age of 69. The Coltrane family sold the spiritual retreat near Malibu last year. For The Frame, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
And that is it for today. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You can find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll be back here tomorrow.